Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable Podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. The opinions expressed on this podcast represent those of the people expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. My guest today is Alex Petty, aka Hoya Capital Real Estate. Alex is president and director of research and ETFs for Hoya Capital Real Estate. Alex has also been a contributing author to Seeking Alpha since 2015, building up a following of more than 12,000 investors with his unparalleled analysis of the U.S. real estate market. In August, he joined the team at the iREIT on Alpha Marketplace service, run by Brad Thomas, which is a very exciting development for real estate investors. More on that during our conversation, I'm sure. Alex is a pretty interesting guy as well. A dual degree holder and two-sport athlete at Georgetown, Alex played baseball and track for the Hoyas while studying finance and real estate. He is a CFA charter holder and holds a Series 65 license. And earlier this year, he launched the Hoya Capital Housing ETF, ticker symbol HOMZ, or HOMES. The performance has been quite good out of the gate. He's a real double threat guy in every sense of the term. You can subscribe to iREIT on Alpha by going to seekingalpha.com and typing iREIT on Alpha into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for iREIT on Alpha there. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Monday, September 16th, 2019. Okay, and we're live. Welcome to the show, Alex. It's truly great to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was watching some of your appearances on ETF IQ and some other places. So the goal here, I think, will be to kind of sharpen up some of what you went over there and get much deeper into why you started this real estate, which is truly unique. I don't really think there's another one like it. And just the real estate markets in general, because obviously we're in a pretty fraught and unprecedented economic environment right now. And so your point of view here will be much appreciated to our listeners.
Sounds good.
Awesome. I'm looking forward. So before we get into today's topic, which is HOMES, a different kind of housing ETF, what's your backstory here? How did you develop an interest in the U.S. real estate market?
Yes, thanks. So we started Hoya back in 2015. As you mentioned, did undergrad. I studied finance, ended up doing a master's degree in real estate finance at Georgetown, met some really, really great professors, and one of which was a former Boston Properties head of acquisitions. And, you know, he's really what kind of turned me on to the REIT sector. Ended up doing three REIT courses as part of this master's degree in real estate, one of which was where Hoya Capital actually kind of started. It was kind of born in one of those classes, which was kind of the overall objective, was to kind of create this company. And so I created Hoya as kind of this research-focused investment advisor, which really under the overall goal, as you said earlier, to kind of make real estate more open to all investors, especially younger investors, because, you know, I think real estate as an asset class is more or less a more institutional asset class. You know, like the nature of REITs is kind of higher yielding, as a little less tax efficient. They're really kind of more suitable for kind of the older, you know, tax advantage crowd. And so I think that a big mission at Hoya really was to kind of make real estate open to the kind of younger crowd. And HOMES was really our first major product launch. Really, HOMES was really created to kind of be this growth oriented real estate investment that is suitable for, you know, for the growth oriented investors, for the renters, which is really where, you know, the need for real estate as an asset class is probably most needed, is really when you are kind of renting and you have this huge mismatch on your asset side of your balance sheet, of your personal balance sheet and your liability side. So yeah, so HOMES kind of launched in March, and so it's been a great first 5.5 months.
Yeah, no, totally. And the performance has been quite good on it. We'll get into that a bit later, I'm sure. And also into a comment that you had there about how this is especially suitable for people that are renting and are not owners of their own home and thus are not really properly allocated to what is in many ways probably the largest asset class in the U.S. In terms of total value. So I guess 2019 has been a year of firsts for you. You launched Homes, and just last month, you also came on as a contributing author and a contributor to Brad Thomas's iREIT on Alpha Marketplace service. So first of all, congratulations on that and on the launch of Homes. What sorts of analysis and tools are you bringing to the table at the iREIT on Alpha service for subscribers there?
Our research has always been kind of macro focused. And so our main research offerings are the sector macro, the real estate sector kind of quarterly research, right? And so really, there's 15 to 18 individual REIT sectors, right? And each of these REIT sectors really is kind of more or less their own kind of independent sector, kind of driven by their own independent kind of macro forces, right? And so there's actually more variation within the REIT sector in the typical year than there is between typical GICS industry groups. And so the average variation between the best performing REIT sector in a given year and the worst performing, it averages about 40 to 45% in a given year versus the average spread between GICS equity sectors, which is closer to 30%. And so I think that there is this big need for real estate, this kind of sector focus, to not see REITs as this kind of monolithic asset class, but there's individual sectors that are more or less suitable for different types of investors, whether you're as I said, a growth-oriented investor or you're a yield-oriented investor. So just by investing in a single fund or just kind of picking REITs, it really kind of discounts that a huge difference in asset classes and sectors. What we try to do in our real estate research is to really present kind of both sides of every sector. And I think that kind of reflects how we've always conducted research. It's been very much kind of trying to present both the bull thesis and the bear thesis and kind of picking apart one by one, each individual point for the bull side and for the bear side. And so each of our sector updates, like a big part of our analysis is the five reasons to be bearish, the five reasons to be bullish. So I think that, we do the sector updates, but then we also do a real estate weekly, which focuses more on the macro data. So on housing data, on jobs data, et cetera. And so, our kind of bread and butter has always been this macro analysis, the kind of sector reports and the macro reports. I think Brad, what Brad does so well is this company level study. I think that there's few analysts.
ETF level also, because he's done some great ETF analysis as part of the service there as well. But yes, agreed. Single name kind of analysis.
Right. It really made sense to kind of join forces there, that to kind of build this institutional quality research platform, which is really what our goal is, to really become this kind of top level institutional quality product. By combining our kind of macro focus, our sector focus, with his more company level study, he's in contact with, he's close with a lot of these management teams. He really has this access. By combining, the micro and the macro together, you really get this institutional quality product. It's a very strong product that I think is on par as any kind of sell side product out there. Our goal is to really continue to kind of build this up, to kind of be this institutional quality offering.
Yeah, sure. No, I love that. In terms of how you're describing the marrying the top-down analysis with the bottoms-up analysis and hopefully ending up with a well-diversified portfolio that's also properly allocated through different market cycles. So yeah, that's very cool and definitely something I take a glance at whenever I want to understand what's happening in real estate markets. So So I think it makes sense for us to split today's conversation into two parts here. I'd like to start by taking a look at the current underlying fundamentals and dynamics of the U.S. residential real estate market before we move over to dive into your fund, the Hoya Capital Housing ETF, ticker symbol HOMZ. Great ticker symbol, by the way. I love it. And the unique way it packages exposure to the real estate market. Starting with the macro picture, the 30-year fixed mortgage rate is down more than 100 basis points from a year ago. It's possible that that's changed slightly since I last wrote this. I know yields have been going up a little, but it's down basically a full percentage point from a year ago. And on the one hand, this should be somewhat bullish for housing demand. On the other hand, there's been a significant uptick in potential home buyers that believe we'll see a recession in the next 12 months, with the majority of those responding saying they'd call off their housing search if the U.S. economy did indeed enter a recession. So two conflicting forces are at play here: lower rates on the one hand, which should be bullish for real estate demand, and on the other hand, kind of the concerns or fears that we're heading into some kind of a global downturn that's likely to make its way to the U.S. economy also. In terms of your read on current housing data, which side do you think has the upper hand?
Right. So I think that the story of last year really was this steady rise in interest rates and in mortgage rates. So at one point last year, the 30-year fixed mortgage rate was higher on a year-over-year basis than it has been in over 10 years. And so when it comes to the single family markets, mortgage rates have a huge impact on the marginal buyer. Really, what you saw last year was this effect of rising rates kind of slowing the single family market. You know, I think what's kind of sometimes lost in that conversation is that you also saw this reacceleration in rent growth. 2018 was actually the best year for growth and household formation since the early 1980s, right? And so there's just really compelling long-term macro housing story that I think is just kind of starting to play out now. Is really driven by kind of two main macro forces, right? So on the supply side, you've seen this significant underbuilding of homes over the last 10 years, but you can kind of trace it back all the way back to about the mid-1990s. And really with the exception of this three-year period between 2002 and 2005, where you saw this huge spike in housing starts, which obviously then preceded the housing crisis, we as a country have been significantly underbuilding homes. And so there's a number of kind of secondary effects that come about when you're underbuilding, one of which is the aging of the existing housing stock. And so the average single family home in America today is the oldest that it ever has been. It's almost 40 years old. And so obviously older homes, as they age, they need exponentially more home improvement spending to kind of keep them fresh. And so I think that on the supply side, there really is this significant undersupply, right? And then on the demand side, what you're seeing now is the largest generation in America, which is the age cohort between about 23 to about early 30s. So this 10-year generation is both significantly larger than the Gen X was in the prior generation. It's significantly larger and it's significantly wealthier. You know, I think a lot of the weak housing trends of the last decade could be really explained at the demographic level, right? So you saw Gen X was a historically small age cohort, and it really entered the kind of most important years of the job market really during the financial crisis. And so, you know, a lot of the, as I said, the weak trends in the housing market, that very much is a demographic story. And that is changing over this next decade. So the 2020s will have the most favorable demographics for the single family housing markets, especially really since the boomer generation started to enter the markets back in the 1970s about. You know, I think that there really is this really compelling thesis of the housing market related to this significant undersupply meeting this significant demand story. And so, you know, I think like that's really what like why we're so excited about homes as really what we see is really the kind of the first product that really captures this entire housing market and captures these themes associated with the housing shortage, with the associated rise in housing costs that are directly linked to this housing shortage, and this really broader demand story of this huge generation. There's going to be 3 million more 35 to 45 year olds in the housing markets in the 2020s as there was in the 2010s. And so, so this overall kind of long-term story, I think that it's just starting to kind of play out now. And so the lower mortgage rates this year, it really has kind of jump-started that, right? Rates, as you said, were down about 90 basis points on a year-over-year basis. Now, that really has significantly stimulated the single-family markets. I think that there's still this persistently kind of negative narrative that I think in some cases is kind of a result of kind of lagging data sets. I think that, housing starts, for example, they're really, even now, they're really reflecting conditions that were kind of February or March, right? It's not like that of a builder, we'll just all of a sudden start to kind of build, as soon as rates go down. You're slowly starting to see that kind of turn. New home sales for June reached the highest rate in almost 12 years. So I think that you really are starting to kind of see this reacceleration in the single family markets. You're starting to see home prices that were kind of decelerating. You're starting to see that stabilize. I think that you're going to see that reaccelerate into year end and then into the next decade. And so I think that these themes of rising housing costs, I think that for the most part, these are themes that are going to be with us for the next, at least 5 to 8 years. Homes is really created in part to kind of capture those themes, but to also kind of give investors this chance to be on the bull side of that, to kind of be on the investor side. Housing is the largest, largest asset class in the world. It's the biggest single component of consumer spending, right? So the average American spends about 33% of their average annual income goes towards housing. And, if you're on the renting side, you have this huge housing liability, this huge liability priced in housing, at least being able to kind of capture some of that upside that you're not just getting crushed on the downside with rising rents, rising housing costs. You at least capture that kind of growth that on the asset side.
So just to circle back on something that you said there and talking about the demographic differences between Gen X and Gen Y, which first of all, I found very interesting. I hadn't realized that Gen X was that much smaller than Gen Y. So that's definitely interesting. So, I mean, there had been a trend after the Great Recession where unemployment rates spiked. It was particularly difficult for college graduates or newly graduated from college individuals to get employment. And so there was an increasing trend of college graduates moving back home after they finished school. What surprised me a little bit is the persistence of that trend, even throughout the economic boom of the last 11 years. I think I read somewhere recently that the percent is the highest it's been in 7 decades and that it's continued moving up over the last decade. Now, so while that suggests a potentially large number of future renters and buyers waiting to enter the housing market, I'm wondering what you think the impetus will be for more of those people to set out on their own and start forming their own households. And I guess you alluded to the fact that that's starting to happen, or that this year was a massive year for new household formation. So just curious how you see that trend reversing.
Right. Yeah. So there's up to about 5 million deferred kind of household formations. Kind of if you were to kind of map out what a normal growth, what the normal percent of household formation should have been versus what it was post-crisis, there's about 5 million of these deferred household growth. And so, I think that what's really at the core of that is the very theme that is that housing costs have continued to outpace wage growth, right? And so this gap, this affordability gap has been getting worse and worse. The more and more that renters are paying towards rent, the higher percentage going towards rent. You know, it's not uncommon to hear young professionals paying more than 50% of their income towards rent, right? And it becomes very difficult to kind of save up when you're also dealing with factors related to, you know, student loans and the overall kind of delay in major life events, that, you know, getting married later, having kids later. Our overall view is that what's holding this particular cohort back is the lack of housing supply, and that, you know, it's the kind of theme that if you build it, you know, like the demand is there. What you're going to need to see is this period of wage growth, which is something that we have been seeing. That is behind what the reacceleration in household formations in 2018 really was. Is that you're finally starting to see this overall income growth. If that can continue, that's going to gradually kind of unleash this deferred household growth. So I think that the combination of, you know, what the housing market needs is more supply. You're not quite seeing as much supply as we need. You hopefully will start to see that supply, you know, over the next 3, 4, 5 years. It kind of slowed in 2018, but like we kind of see that to kind of re-jumpstart in 2019 and into 2020. You know, so I think that you will eventually see that supply growth, which will, you know, have the effect of at least moderating this rise in housing costs. But it really is, you know, it is very dependent on the jobs market. Like what you're really going to need to see is solid income growth. And I think that ultimately will be what will solve a lot of the issues with this particular cohort.
Sure, although lower rates, which lower monthly pricing, don't hurt either. So, you know, perhaps that explains, as you said, some of the big boost we've seen over the last year. So I'd love to get into the home builders for a bit. The home builders have really been on a tear since the reversal that started the Boxer Day massacre, and then everything kind of came back. But home builders have come back even more so than other sectors. So for example, exchange-traded funds like XHB and ITB are up 32 and 38% respectively year-to-date versus roughly half that for the S&P 500. How do you view home builder valuations at current prices, considering this huge run-up we've seen?
Yes, like the strong performance this year really, really comes after 2018, which was actually the worst year for the home building sector since 2007. So what's really interesting about XHB and ITB is that they're actually still trading below the levels that they were when they launched in 2006. Like these ETFs really kind of launched right into the probably the worst possible time that as a home builder you could launch, which was in 2006.
So it's amazing to me, just as an aside, it's amazing how often series of ETF launches on the same theme are indicators for just a toppiness in that sector. So we saw just a slew, for example, of cannabis ETFs come to market as just the bottom was falling out completely from those stocks there. So I wonder if it was a bit of the same also with the home builder ETFs launching right before everything went bottom up there.
Yes, like they launched in 2006. From peak to trough, they were down about 80%. What's interesting is that you haven't seen any real major kind of housing ETF launch since then. And I think that is something that really continues to surprise us as an ETF issuer, that there really was this lack of product in this particular space. And so Homes is not, you know, directly a home builder, you know, ETF. These home builder ETFs have kind of come to represent the housing market. You know, I think that, you know, you could make the case that they probably shouldn't be kind of representing the housing market because they really are kind of single family focused. And they're not only single family focused, they're kind of focused on kind of the marginal change in the single family market. So, you know, that they're home builder focused, right? So they're more or less a play on the marginal growth of the single family market. It's obviously been very strong performance really since really bottoming back in December. You know, I think that this kind of reflects this kind of growing realization of these big macro trends that you are starting to see. It's reflecting the lower mortgage rates, obviously. You know, but I think from a valuation perspective, I don't think that they're terribly out of line with the kind of historical levels. And so I think that there's certainly more upside in the builders, you know, but I think that there's probably more kind of lingering upside in the other kind of housing sectors that are kind of linked to builders. The home building products you've seen have a really good year. You've started to finally see the real estate brokerage firms, the real estate tech firms, that the overall single family acceleration this year has really been more than just a builder story.
Yeah, definitely. And one more question before we pivot over to homes and start digging into the specifics there. So the home builders have also outperformed residential REIT ETFs like REZ, which is up 25% year to date. So not too shabby, but significantly less than the home builders. As you just pointed out, the home builders are really just a play on a very small slice of the housing market, whereas a fund like REZ is more of a play on the rental market. So just curious if you could talk a bit about the current dynamics in the rental market and how that's somewhat different from the home buyer market.
Right. Yeah. So the rental market has really kind of re-accelerated since about mid-2018. So what the multifamily market in particular has been dealing with is this oversupply in the kind of luxury multifamily category, right? Like we've seen very high levels of housing starts in that particular category. And that's pressured rents from, you know, after peaking in 2014, I think national rent growth was close to 5% in 2014, which is really, really high. It kind of steadily kind of decelerated to about 1% to 2% growth, kind of bottomed in 2018. We've really started to kind of see that re-acceleration. I think that part of that is linked to mortgage rates, but I think that there's also that bigger demographic story that's kind of also playing out. But the more compelling thesis in the rental REIT sector is, I think, the single family rental operators. You know, I think that these REITs are really kind of right at the kind of forefront of what I think will kind of be the kind of first wave of this overall housing thesis in the 2020s. And that as this huge generation that's currently kind of still in the multifamily markets, you know, I think that the desire to kind of live the single family lifestyle is still very active. And so I think that what's kind of taken the place of the old kind of starter home is this single family rental home, right? And so the advantage for kind of renting a single family home is that, like, this generation, this kind of rent by choice, they're kind of more comfortable renting longer and longer, and that it's these single family operators that are really going to see this kind of first wave. And so the kind of lines between the single family rental operators and the home builders have actually been increasingly blurred over the last really 4 or 5 years. You've seen some of the REITs start to build out kind of in-house single family home building teams. Like, that's a theme that I think is really interesting. I think that's something that is going to play out over the next 4, 5, 6 years, is that these single family rental REITs are really going to become kind of these more active builders. And I think that the home builders themselves are going to increasingly lean on these single family or the kind of institutional rental operator, knowing that this demographic wave is comfortable renting, right? And is kind of more skeptical of owning than prior age cohorts. And so I think the long-term performance of the residential REIT sector is also a really interesting theme. And, you know, I think that pretty much over every time period, if you chart REZ against like the kind of broad-based REIT ETFs, REZ is significantly kind of outperformed the kind of broader REIT basket. And I think that it really is because of these underlying themes of housing shortage, of rising rents. And, you know, like, these are themes that I think will only kind of accelerate towards 2025, you know, 2030.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's interesting.
I am speaking with Alex Petty, a.k.a. Hoya Capital Real Estate of the iREIT on Alpha Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to iREIT on Alpha by going to seekingalpha.com and typing iREIT on Alpha, that's I-R-E-I-T on Alpha, into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for iREIT on Alpha there.
So I'd love to pivot over to Homes, the ETF you launched back in March of this year. The fund is really first in class in that it combines just every slice and dice of the residential housing market in the US. So it's got mortgage REITs like Equity Residential. It's got home builders like D.R. Horton and KB Home in it. It's got home improvement companies like Lowe's and Home Depot. And then home financing like Wells Fargo and JP Morgan and tech innovators like Zillow. Where did you come up with the idea to combine the entire US housing market into a single ETF? It's really a brilliant and fascinating product.
Homes is really designed to kind of be the kind of new benchmark for the entire housing market, right? So now there's, you know, there's the home builder ETFs, which are pretty much entirely focused on the single family markets and really, really the single family building markets. And then on the other side, there's the, you know, the REIT ETFs, which are entirely focused on the rental markets. There was really nothing out there that really kind of saw the housing market as its own sector. Our goal with Homes was to really kind of try to capture as faithfully as possible, the overall housing market, right? So to kind of capture all companies that are really involved in the housing market, which goes way beyond home builders and goes way beyond REITs. Our kind of overall themes that we're really trying to capture are these themes of rising housing costs, of this housing shortage theme, of this overall undersupply of housing story, meeting this huge age cohort that is kind of coming full steam into the housing markets now. And so really what Homes was really created to do was really to address this core investment need, especially of this growth-oriented real estate investor. And that is that housing is the largest single spending category for the average person. And Homes is really kind of that kind of hedge almost against rising housing costs. And so it's kind of designed to kind of fill that gap on the investor balance sheet of the asset side and of the liability side, that real estate as an asset class is significantly underrepresented in a typical, you know, S&P 500 index fund. REITs are only about 3-4% of the entire S&P. You have 3-4% of your portfolio in real estate. Meanwhile, you're spending 30% or 40% of your income going towards essentially real estate. And so it's this huge gap, and it kind of goes to that overall theme of that. Why are people that this whole deferred, that this 5 million deferred household growth and that, you know, rents and housing costs have been outpacing wages, and that Homes is really kind of hopefully designed to be kind of that kind of equalizer where you could at least kind of match your liability exposure with your asset exposure. And so, yeah, Homes kind of breaches the traditional classification lines of the home building sector kind of being seen completely distinct from the REIT sector. It was kind of designed to be kind of this modern take on the housing category as a whole.
Yeah, sure. No, and I think you pull that off fairly brilliantly. So the fund tracks the Hoya Capital Housing 100 Index. There are very specific rules governing inclusion and weightings by sector in this index. Could you just run through those quickly for people that want a better understanding of why the weightings and sector caps are the way they are? There's four basic buckets in there, but I'll let you drill into the specifics and the weightings and how you kind of arrived at those.
Right. Yeah. So the goal of Homes was to really capture total spending on housing and housing related services. Right. And so the index design process was really kind of this two-stage approach. It was one, to define what is the housing market, and then two, to kind of see what is investable at the housing market and how can we faithfully represent total spending on housing using, you know, highly liquid U.S.-based companies. What we kind of found in our research is that the total housing market is roughly a $4-5 trillion industry. About a third of GDP is kind of housing and kind of the broader housing sector. We basically broke it into kind of four major categories and of eight subcategories. The first being the home ownership and rental sector, right? This kind of represented the $1.5 trillion in rents and implied rents spent in each year. And so there's about 30% of the index is in this category. There's 20 companies. This is mostly kind of our residential REIT basket. So we have single family rental operators. We have multifamily. We have manufactured housing. We have some student housing. We have some senior housing. The second major bucket is the home building and construction category. So this is also about 30%. This is typically what you would find in the home builder ETFs. And so this is your 10 largest single family home builders. this is your home building products. So you have your, you know, your Masco, your Mohawk, you have a few timber REITs in there, you have a few window makers, you have other...
Caterpillar, are they in there?
Yeah.
They are, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Sure.
Or no, I think that they're actually not. But yeah, no, there's 30 names in all in the home building and construction category. And then there's the two categories which are kind of nowhere to be found in kind of either the kind of REIT bucket or the home building bucket, which is the, you know, the home financing services and tech category. So this includes some of the largest mortgage banks. It includes home insurers, title insurers, mortgage insurers, data providers that provide for these insurance companies. It includes companies like Zillow, like Redfin, Remax, like these companies that are really fundamentally housing companies that are really that are kind of not seen in any other kind of housing related fund out there. And then finally, our last category is the home improvement and furnishings category. So, you know, you have your Home Depot, you have your Lowe's, your Williams Sonoma, Restoration Hardware.
Sure. No, that's definitely clarifying in terms of what kind of things investors can expect in here. And again, some things that I think they would expect and some things that maybe they wouldn't just because of how investors have been trained to think about real estate funds and the real estate sector and, you know, GICS classifications. You know, they broke out real estate about 5 years back as its own 11th sector group, but a lot of these firms are obviously missing from there.
Yeah, no, like there's way more to real estate than REITs, and there's more to housing than the builders, right? So homes is really kind of it's really our kind of take on kind of capturing as much as possible the entire housing market.
Totally, yeah. I mean, what is a company like Zillow or Remax if they're not a residential real estate company? They're, you know, probably classified as a financial or a tech company, but they really draw their cues and their earnings, their top line, their bottom line from the real estate market. And so, yeah, it makes total sense to include them in the basket there. So in terms of the types of investors that you think this fund is, I don't want to say most suitable for you. Obviously, nothing here is a recommendation. Well, you know, we disclaim up the wazoo at the beginning and end of this also. It threads the difference between some of the home builder ETFs, which primarily aim to provide investors capital appreciation, and then many of the REITs, which are predominantly there to provide investors with interest income. And I'm just curious if you view this as more of a kind of capital gains, long stock fund or more of an income play.
Right. So I think that it kind of is, yeah, that the, you know, like the REITs, as I mentioned, they're kind of more suitable for the kind of older investors, in tax advantaged accounts. Like the builders, for the most part, you know, especially these XHB, really kind of more or less have historically been seen as more of a trading vehicle. They're very high beta. As I said, they're really capturing changes in the single family market as opposed to the kind of single family market itself. Yeah, so homes is kind of this middle ground. I would say, you know, like the kind of historical beta is about 0.8, 0.9. And so it's kind of still kind of on the defensive side, but you know, like we really designed it to be the kind of suitable for the growth oriented real estate investor that, you know, like might not be so focused on yield, but is, yeah, you know, looking for more of that capital appreciation, but also not looking for the high beta of the traditional home builder funds. So like it's kind of designed to kind of be this kind of middle ground, more defensively oriented, but still higher growth real estate product that I think is really particularly suitable for especially this kind of renting crowd, this crowd that's significantly underexposed to the housing markets. And can really kind of use homes as kind of this kind of hedge to kind of equalize some of that exposure, but also, you know, the average homeowner, right? That is really lacks the full diversification of the housing market. You know, so they own, you know, a single home on a single block, you know, in a single neighborhood in a single state. You know, like when you're looking at the national housing market, you know, an individual home, while it might represent, you know, on a personal balance sheet level, you know, like it might represent you're at least not so exposed to the rising housing cost theme. You are still exposed to the capital appreciation side of owning an asset that is really not diversified. And so homes was also designed for that current home owner to kind of add that diversification to really what is their largest and most important asset class.
Sure. Yeah. If the cost, for example, of maintaining their house goes up, at least they would benefit on that side of it. While paying the additional costs, at least they'd be reaping the benefits of owning many of those companies in a diversified portfolio. So I was trying to come up with a way of replicating what Homes does by combining three or four separate ETFs. And there were really just still way too many components that were missing from the fund. And so congrats on that. I'm curious what other unique fund launches Hoya has in its pipeline. For example, any plans for an ex-US equivalent of Homes?
To answer the last question first, I think that the ex-US, we've explored that. You know, I think that what makes the US markets unique is just how investable that it really is. You know, I think that the challenge for ETF issuers, even if you have this really, really compelling theme, you need to be able to accurately and faithfully represent that theme. What we're so excited about with Homes and with this particular category is that there is such a wealth of highly liquid domestic companies that you can faithfully represent these really compelling macro themes. I think that is something that, you know, ETF issuers, that's a significant hurdle that everybody kind of runs into. You know, if you look at some of the smaller kind of themed ETFs, is that there's this balance between liquidity, between tradability, between accurate representation. There's usually trade-offs. There's usually that if you want the pure play, that you're going to have to dabble into some really small names. And the end result is you could have a product that's relatively kind of less liquid. And so I think that this is pretty unique in that you're not sacrificing any liquidity. And in fact, you know, I think that we design Homes to be the most liquid housing ETF. And so the ETF liquidity is I think that's something that is commonly misunderstood, in that, you know, I think people kind of look at use stock metrics to look at ETF liquidity. But really, the ETF liquidity is really more of a function of the underlying basket holdings. And so that is a function of both what percentage is in the basket. You know, a lower percentage of, you know, top 10 holdings typically means a more liquid basket. It's easier to kind of trade in and out of those securities and not have a huge impact on the underlying market. And so during the index design process, we were really looking at that liquidity with kind of these grand ambitions of that, you know, we think that this will be seen by hedge funds, by insurance funds, as the most direct way to play directional views on the housing market. And so we looked at the total basket. And so we tried to create a product that is relatively more liquid. And so that was a huge part of our process. And kind of in terms of what we're kind of looking at going forward, the most logical at this point is kind of a higher yield complement to Homes. So kind of using what our bread and butter is, which is kind of the sector by sector breakdowns, and to kind of make sure that a higher quality, high yield product, which I think is currently kind of lacking in the ETF marketplace, which I think that typically, at least in the yield sector, there's a lot of kind of yield chasing, right? And so I think that typically when you're investing in these higher yields, I think that you typically pay for it at the total return level. And I think what's really interesting is that if you actually look at the factor analysis in REITs, what has been the biggest winner over pretty much every recent time period from a total return basis has been lower yielding REITs. And that it's kind of counterintuitive that the kind of simplest way to outperform the REIT index is to pick the lowest yielding REITs. And I think that is kind of the exact opposite approach that a lot of investors take. You know, I think what's really driving that is that, you know, there's this inverse correlation between quality and yield. But I think that there is this opportunity to create an index product that is kind of a high quality yield focused real estate ETF that doesn't sacrifice quality, but that does kind of tap into the more higher yielding names that are higher yielding, not because they of corporate governance issues, not because of other company level issues, but more because that the real estate sector itself is more of a yield focused REIT sector as opposed to a more growth focused REIT sector. You know, I think that like we're really going to need to see that same kind of compelling long-term theme that we see with homes to kind of launch future products.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense and sounds like a great idea for a fund launch. And in the meantime, investors can go over to iREIT.alpha and they can see your analysis there and get that single REIT analysis until said fund comes into being or probably even after as well. Anyway, I wanted to thank you for being so generous with your time today, Alex. So beyond reading all the great content you produce here at Seeking Alpha and at iREIT.alpha, what's the best way for investors that want to continue researching homes or the housing markets generally to go about doing that?
Yeah, so our ETF website is thehousingetf.com. Yeah, so we also publish daily commentary on our website. We publish, obviously, quite a bit on Seeking Alpha. We do our real estate daily updates. We do our weekly updates. We do our sector reports. We cover home builders. We cover all 15 real estate sectors. There's no wealth of housing market commentary. I think it's really important to kind of make sure that investors, they're kind of getting the underlying data. The housing coverage is prone to kind of narrative-driven housing commentary. There's no shortage of housing data. And so I think that it's critical that investors really do as much of their own front research as possible.
Yeah, no, totally. And you're pretty active on social, I know, on Twitter. What's your handle there? Where can investors find you online beyond thehousingetf.com?
Yeah, we're at Hoya Capital on Twitter. We're on LinkedIn. We share pretty much all of our research. That's been kind of our core model, is that like we're doing this research anyway. And so I think that there's the opportunity through Seeking Alpha, as we're doing it, to share as much of it as possible.
Alex, I want to thank you. This has been really, really great.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's all for today. If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. We're on all of them at this point. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. We just spoke with Alex Petty, aka Hoya Capital Real Estate of the iREIT on Alpha Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to iREIT on Alpha by going to seekingalpha.com and typing iREIT on Alpha into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for iREIT on Alpha there. You can also follow Hoya Capital Real Estate on Seeking Alpha and enjoy Alex's free content there. For disclosures, Alex's long homes, HOMZ, you can download a full list of Holmes's holdings updated daily at www.thehousingetf.com. Alex is also long HD and VNQ. I, Jonathan Liss, am long VNQ via my parents' non-tax deferred account.